take your time to set up, but I'll go ahead and call the case while you get ready. Our second case this morning is number 21-10372, Jocelyn Commandant versus the District Director. Mr. Prada, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Prada and I represent the appellants. The jurisdictional issues in this case—
Let me just, before you begin, I don't want to interrupt you during the flow of your argument. So with the motion that you filed to add parties as interveners, and I know the government hasn't responded yet, and you can just file your response in due course, you indicated that right now there, although we haven't been given anything else in the case, that there is only one appellant left, given the offers that the government made with regards to some forms of relief and the acceptance of that offer by a number of your clients, right? So that the one who's left, as I understand it, is Mr. Karius.
Yes, that's correct. Nothing has changed since then.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The dispositive issue in this case is whether the removal orders were executed by departure. So the government's theory is that because of Section 304C of the Matina, that is an exception to the general rule of 111G.
That is not the dispositive issue in this appeal. I know that the ultimate merits, but we have to address our jurisdiction before, or the jurisdiction of the district court, I should say, before we get there. And that's what I personally, for me, that's what I'd like for you to focus on. I know you want to talk about the merits issue, but we need to discuss whether the jurisdiction stripping statutes as relied on by the government and the APA under its exhaustion doctrine applies here.
And yes. we'll let you get to the merits at the end, but take up Judge Luck's question first.
Yes, so with regard to A5, B9, and G, the government's argument is that we're making an indirect attack on the removal order. So we're saying that that's not the case because the removal orders no longer exist because they have been executed. Now, this court's case law in Madu, Camarena, and Argueta-Romero state that that sort of claim is cognizable. It's not barred by A5, B9, and G. So in that sense, the merits and the jurisdictional questions seem to merge. But really, in the exhaustion claim that the government's arising, that's
they where don't seem to merge, though, in the Patel jurisdiction stripping provision. Would you agree with that?
Yes, that's a separate issue.
Let's address that.
Okay, yes. So we have three reasons why we think Patel, as it now stands, does not bar these claims. So the first one is that we're challenging an agency policy. And in order to do so, we need to have standing. So we're bringing claims under the APA.
So let's assume that I agree with you that under some sort of Bivens 1983, it wouldn't be 1983, it'd be Bivens, or under the APA, there is this exception that allows you to attack policies and procedures, practice and policies, as you term them. Reading your complaint, and especially the relief section, it seems to me that you're doing way more than asking for a declaration that this policy or practice is either inconsistent with law or arbitrary and capricious. What you're asking for, and I'm paraphrasing here, is a declaration that the plaintiffs were inspected and admitted into TPS status for purposes of their adjustment. You're asking for a remand of their applications for them to adjudicate, but not just to adjudicate their applications, but to adjudicate consistent with the declaration that you have sought. In other words, give me the relief that I want. And then also an order we want, you're asking for an order to the service to adjudicate all pending and future class applications consistent with these declarations. That seems to be far, far more than a pattern and practice claim, and kind of consistent with what we articulated was not going to happen with regard to these sorts of claims in the Haitian refugee case, where we said this is not meant as an end round around the administrative process.
So two responses, Your Honor. First, we need to establish standing to bring a claim. A person cannot just challenge a government policy because they believe it's wrong. So
there's no doubt you have standing, you're injured, but that doesn't dictate your relief. That just dictates, are you injured in fact?
So it may be, we filed the case prior to Patel, so it may be that the relief may need to be narrowed. I'm not disputing that. But what we're saying is that under the APA, we alleged a failure to act, unreasonable delay, and unlawful agency action, because we had cases that were denied, but also cases that were administratively closed, which is basically held in abeyance and not acted upon. So we needed to allege this to show the injury. Now, in terms of the relief, it may be that it may need to be narrowed to simply a declaration.
And I appreciate your candor, counsel, I do. I won't call it a concession because you haven't, but that's pretty close to an admission that we're in a part that's outside of a general pattern and practice claim of the kind that you want this to serve as an exception on it.
So the second point is the McNary case from the Supreme Court. So in McNary, they recognized that these persons were asking for the SAW applications. Now, the SAW applications and application for residence applied for outside of immigration court in the first instance. So it would have been the INS function equivalent to USCIS today. And in McNary, the court stated that you're seeking relief for more than just an individual. And that's a third point, actually, because we believe the A2BI is focused on individuals. But regarding McNary, they recognize that the litigants in that case were not seeking grants. They were not seeking a positive or negative exercise of discretion. They were asking for discretion to be exercised.
So I don't know that I read McNary exactly like you do, but even if I did, the part of the and why I emphasized it when I was speaking is not just that you're asking the service, I'll call it the service to adjudicate your applications. That might be closer to the mark, even though I don't know that I read McNary the same way. What you do is ask them to adjudicate the applications consistent with the declaration that you are seeking. That's asking for a result. That's not asking for an exercise of discretion.
Well, in a sense, what the McNary case was challenging a policy as well. And for them to succeed, the court would have to say that policy needs to be changed. So to remand the applications to the agency without a declaration, I don't think it would achieve anything.
The whole point. Exactly why this is an end round. The point of a practice or policy isn't to achieve anything other than a declaration that something is or not consistent with the law. You then can take that declaration, go to the service and say, hey, the law is this, and go act accordingly. But it seems to me that this is exactly what we warned against as an end run by seeking something. You're trying to get something for your clients. I don't begrudge you of that, but I'm having trouble seeing this as falling within a very narrow exception of pattern and practice claims.
There would be no redressability. Those type of claims would be meaningless if there was no redressability.
Of course you would. You'd have a declaration that the policy applying to your client is unconstitutional or inconsistent with law. I mean, that's...
Okay, so if I can clarify, are you asking about the difference between a simple declaration and a remand for a procedure in accordance with the declaration?
I'm only asking you, counsel, that whether a pattern and practice claim can be one that seeks not just a declaration that a pattern of practice is wrong, but also seeks affirmative relief for your client that discretion be exercised in their favor consistent with that declaration.
With regard to the declaration itself, standing alone, I believe that we solidly can request that. So I understand your question to be with regard to the additional relief of a remand for a new adjudication. And if that's being the case, well, remand is the typical relief in an APA case. As the DC Circuit describes it, an APA case is basically an appeal from the agency to the district court sitting as an appellate tribunal. So my understanding of the APA is that a district court cannot order an approval or an approval on remand. They don't decide the case. They say there is an error here. We enjoin the error. We declare that this error occurred, and the case gets sent back, and then the agency needs to proceed in accordance with the law. So my understanding of the APA is that is the point of it. And
that's true of every other agency other than ones where jurisdiction has been stripped for exactly that sort of thing. And that's the issue, right? That's why we're here, because in the immigration context, to streamline things, Congress has made a call that said what normally happens for administrative claims is not going to happen here. We want them to go directly for due process purposes to allow some review to the Court of Appeals.
So, right? So I think this turns to my third point about the statute's text itself, that it's targeted to individualized decisions. So 1252A in the beginning passage says a final order of removal may be reviewed under the Hobbs Act and according with the following procedures. 1252A2BI says a determination, a judgment, if I'm stating it correctly. So this is individualized language. And in McNary, what the Supreme Court did was tell Congress that if you want to broaden these provisions beyond individual determinations, you need to use specific language, such as all claims arising under. For example, we find that in 1250.
Yeah, but the Supreme Court didn't say this is the exclusive way to do it. I mean, whether we're wrong in Patel or not is a separate story. And, the government may have a point that we really should wait for Patel, the Supreme Court's Patel decision, before we do anything. But at least as I read our Patel decision as it exists right now, any decision, discretionary or non-discretionary, related to this falls within the jurisdiction stripping provision. And it would seem to me that a determination by the service that we don't have jurisdiction or you're in the wrong court is a discretionary or non-discretionary determination related to an application for adjustment of status. I mean, I'm having trouble seeing how that doesn't fit exactly in the very broad way that we've read.
Well, in Patel, the word any was used to broaden the scope of judgment to include both discretionary and non-discretionary determinations. So this is an alternative argument that we made, that there actually is no determination in this case. So it wouldn't follow.
And I know you make that argument, but how is we don't have jurisdiction not a determination?
Because when an agency declares it doesn't have jurisdiction, it's declaring that it may not act in a case. So there is no agency action.
That's an action. I mean, the decision not to act is itself an action, right?
But then it's also a failure to act. It's basically why we pleaded the case as a failure to act under Norton versus Southern Western.
But in that scenario, let's take it out of the immigration context. Agency decisions to not act for jurisdictional reasons are reviewable, are they not, generally speaking?
Yes, that's what.
Right. If someone petitions an agency to do X, and the agency says, "Thank you for your petition, but we don't have any jurisdiction to act," that's reviewable, isn't it? Under the APA, is it not?
Yes, because courts can determine the authority of agencies to act or not. It's
right. Whether it chooses to act or not is a discretionary matter, different question. But if the answer is we can't, we just aren't able to do it, we have no authority, that's reviewable. Let me ask you a question that sort of maybe goes to your analogy of the merit and jurisdiction being enmeshed somehow. So from a practical perspective, why is the government wrong in saying that, and the service in saying that, you needed to go to the IJ because you had a removal order pending against you?
Well, the one argument is that the order is executed. There's nothing to reopen at that point. And in fact,
who executed the order?
Our client, because 101G, when he traveled abroad, our argument is that when he traveled abroad, he departed the statute.
But he did it with the government's permission.
Yes, but 101G says that when a person departs, regardless of where the costs come from, basically aimed at whether the person leaves voluntarily or forcibly by the government, and I believe that's to cover an entire spectrum. So the situation of I sought out permission voluntarily and used it voluntarily with the imprimatur of the government's approval, it's within that spectrum of the extremes, where I just leave on my own and I don't tell anybody, or they grab me and throw me out of the country. So it still falls within 101G's scope. 101G is supposed to be an extremely broad statute. And I believe the legislative history was designed to capture certain persons who would cross the border repeatedly without the INS, or the predecessor to INS there. And it was designed so that Congress didn't need to allocate all these funds to make sure every person's removed individually in order to bring upon the penalties that arise from illegal.
Right, so how do you treat the statutory language that says that when you return, you have the same status that you had before?
Yes,
it's the same status minus the removal order? So what status does that mean?
I wanted to speak about that because the Fifth Circuit's decision addresses that. And then two parts of the Fifth Circuit's decision, they speak about the specific general canon. In the later discussion of it, they cite a case, Rad LAX Hotel. And that canon, it only applies when there's a conflict in a statute. According to Scalia's decision in Rattelli-X, the point of that canon is to resolve contradictions or to avoid superfluities here. So we are both proffering different definitions of the word status. Given that courts must give meaning or should give meaning to all phrases and provisions in a statute, and you're confronted with two different interpretations of the word status, one that creates no contradiction or another that does, and let's assume they're both reasonable, and I'm not conceding that point, but if they are both reasonable, I believe that the courts should adopt the reasoning that does not create a contradiction, so you don't have to rely upon a specific canon of a specific general. And in this case, the statute itself, the Matina, and the C2 speaks about who this applies to. It says the people with family unity, persons with temporary protected status under the permanent provision, and including aliens provided such status under Section 303. So just looking at the statute by itself, it's using the word status to refer to these three classes of individuals based on the fact that they already have a status. Now, there's case law from the Fifth Circuit, the Gomez case, that says unlawful status is not really a thing. There can only be a lack of status. The dissent from rehearing in the Tula Rubio case, which is, it's four judges compared to the two circuit judges in the majority decision, and that's precedent there, but not here. But I think the dissent from rehearing on Bonk in that case is very important because they survey the Ninth Circuit, the Second Circuit, BIA cases, and possibly another circuit, that it has been consistently understood that a status is something that a statute gives you. It brings benefits. It's defined by a statute. And anything else is a lack of status. For example, a person who has deferred action as a childhood arrival, the Dreamers, the DACA case, they're given work permits. They're allowed to be here. It's not a status. DHS repeatedly tells the courts it's not a status. It's just permission to be here. So status is something more than your condition. And the position that the government's taking here is inconsistent with positions it's taken in other cases. And
so your view is that status means someone with TPS grounds for staying here.
Yes, and that's it. No other qualifications.
Got it. Okay. We've taken you way over your time, yes. Mr. Prada, but thank you very much, and you've saved your time for rebuttal. Mr. Bateman.
Good morning.
You'll be filing a response to the motion for intervention.
That is right, okay. Judge Jordan. Though it is the government's position that this panel could rule from the bench that at this late stage that it is improper. Obviously, it's in front of the panel or to the panel's discretion. However, Hall is still good law in the 11th Circuit.
And we're not going to be ruling from the bench. So you please go ahead and file your response, and we'll go ahead and take up the motion. There's no need for there's no need to do this like immediately.
Thank you.
Especially since we have Patel pending in the Supreme Court. And that adds a wrinkle to how we decide to adjudicate this appeal. So just file your response in due course, and then we'll take it up.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is this case moot? Do you believe this case is moot?
This case is not moot.
Why not?
Because Mr. Karius still has a claim to press.
Because he rejected the settlement that the government has agreed to jointly reopen and dismiss. Dismiss might not be the right word, so I apologize, but to get rid of the orders of removal.
To terminate his removal order. That's right. Whereas the other 13 appellants, one of them, it turns out, because the agency the entire time has been looking diligently at the cases of these 14 appellants, turns out one of them, Mr. Jean-Claude, actually had executed his removal order because he traveled without TPS. But for the other 13, with the exception of Mr. Karius, the other, I guess, 12 have accepted this offer because they want to use their administrative remedies so that they may terminate the removal order and so that they may adjust status.
Do you agree that there is such a thing as a pattern or practice claim?
In the abstract, yes. Do I believe that there's one in this case? No.
Tell me what that would look like if I wanted to attack a written or unwritten policy that those who travel with government position on TPS status do not have their orders of removal executed and therefore are still pending.
I think the court need only look at the cases that appellant's attorneys put forth. So, for instance, Haitian Refugee Center, where you have a program that is set up to focus on a particular subset.
I will say this. There's obviously litigation. Counsel here is not the only counsel to have made this claim around the country. It looks like there are these sorts of claims around the country. Others have made these sort of pattern of practice claims, and the government files a motion to dismiss in all of them. That's the government's right. But I guess what I'm asking is, when would the government not file a motion to dismiss on the basis of the jurisdiction stripping statute?
So Patel aside, and obviously it's the government's position that this court's understanding of 1252A2B1 bars jurisdiction. It's also still the government's position that
I get it. You think we're wrong. We understand.
There's no program here. This is the law that was applied. And you can't just say that, well, we're challenging the law, so we're challenging a policy. That way we get to go blow past the jurisdiction stripping statute. So the court has asked, what is an example of a claim that would be able to actually show a policy or a pattern or practice? Well, the government would have first affirmatively had to create a program that said, we're going to treat these particular type of appellants.
How's that possible? I'm trying to think, how's that possible? If the government has a policy that is inconsistent with positive law, doesn't the APA or some sort of Bivens due process, something allows the plaintiffs to come and say, the government is applying, whether written or unwritten, a policy against us that is contrary to the positive law that would entitle us to relief, right? That has to exist.
So as far as making sure that these appellants have the ability to have judicial recourse, what they're claiming is we don't have a removal order. Well, they can go in front of the immigration judge and say, we executed our removal order.
I agree with them legally that the removal order has been executed or terminated because of the government-approved travel? What if I agree with that? And so there is no removal order, and so they're in a weird box where you're saying there's no jurisdiction and...
But they're not in a weird position because they can still move to reopen in front of the BIA or the immigration judge. It depends on where they were at in immigration proceedings. And then that immigration judge, they will say, hey, immigration judge, we executed. And the immigration judge will either say, yes, I agree that you did. There is no more removal order. You're out of here. Or the immigration judge would disagree and say, I don't think you did because you traveled on Matina. And then they could appeal that to the BIA. And then the adverse order from the BIA, they could appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals. So there is a way for them to get judicial recourse of this legal question that they have.
Is your contention that the removal orders weren't self-executed, or that it doesn't matter because of the language of Matina, that they get back the status they had before? Or are those one and the same?
Your Honor, first off, the government would submit that the merits were not properly briefed because Patel was what the district court dismissed the lower court on, and would ask if the court would like the government can submit supplemental briefing. Matina, going now to the core of the court's question, Matina says that plaintiffs in this position shall be inspected and admitted in the same immigration status they had upon departure. When they were here originally, they had a removal order. When they returned, they cannot be in a better position. They still have the removal order.
But if you execute it, take the gentleman whose name you mentioned at the beginning who was different.
Yes.
He traveled without government permission or without status.
Correct. Right?
He self-executed his removal order, right?
That's right, because Matina did not apply to him.
Why did not apply to him? Because he wasn't TPS status at the time?
No, because he didn't ask for, he didn't travel on advance parole.
He didn't get government permission.
Got it.
Right.
Okay. So when he comes back, he doesn't have a status.
When he comes back...
he has no underlying status. The government can treat him in a certain way because he's returned to the country and he's either inadmissible or entered illegally or whatever, but he has no underlying status that precedes his subsequent reentry into the country, right?
Correct.
You'd have to file a new NTA to
start him all over again.
Correct. A new notice to appear in immigration proceedings.
Okay. So it's only because these individuals, and I refer to them in a, as a group before some of them accepted the government's overtures, it's only because they were in TPS status, asked for permission, traveled with parole and came back that you think that the removal order still exists.
Remains, that is right. But the court's questions highlight a great point as far as the overtures made by the government. This is our second alternative argument. There are administrative remedies available to all these plaintiffs. They can move to reopen, which...
I tend to agree with you on the St. Cyr thing, which is what I think you're referring to. The fact that the government may be mistaken doesn't matter. They can go to court and say the government's mistaken. But the pattern and practice thing is where I want to focus, because for whatever reason, we've carved this out. And something has to fall within that. It has to mean something.
And again, in Haitian refugee, and again, in McNary, the court found constitutional violations in the claims that were pressed.
Why would that matter if it's statutory or constitutional? You're right that those are all constitutional claims. And so this wouldn't, I think it wouldn't maybe not fall under a Bivens type action, but what does that matter if it's constitutional or statutory?
Well, as far as, again, making sure that there is judicial recourse, perhaps it does not matter. But again, through the immigration courts, through the BIA to the PIA, to the circuit court, there is judicial recourse available. With McNary in particular, and as Judge Luck brought up earlier, in McNary, it actually says these plaintiffs have not asked for a declaration. These plaintiffs aren't asking for actual, you know, merits relief. But these plaintiffs, in this case, are. Another thing was that in McNary, those special...
So I just want to be clear. So it would be, assuming the relief section, that the provisions that I read or summarized, if those were gone and all the relief that was sought was a declaration that this written or unwritten policy is wrong and that the orders of removal are in fact have in fact been executed or terminated, and that's it, that would be okay under Haitian refugee and McNary.
No. I'm going to go on with actually McNary, some other distinctions, reasons that these plaintiffs can't bring this program, pattern, practice claim. Another instance was there was no judicial recourse, at least not in McNary. McNary makes clear that those special agricultural worker or SAW applicants weren't in removal proceedings. They could be placed in removal proceedings, but they weren't in removal proceedings.
But the Haitian refugee plaintiffs did have some review, correct?
They did, but that goes to the core of that case in that the record that they could provide the circuit court was going to be truncated because they barely had lawyers. They were given, you know, half an hour. There were all kind of reasons. There were due process and right to counsel violations in that instance. I don't want to overspeak. Due process violations, I think, is what's in the case. Whereas here, in another point that plaintiffs have made in their briefing is there's not going to be an adequate record. This is a question of law that would come up to the circuit court. There's not going to be a great outstanding factual record to talk about their travel and all this kind of stuff that has to gestate in immigration court. It's this question of law that they could have reviewed. And so the record would be quite adequate. So the government's first position is there is not a pattern or practice challenge here in the first place. Secondly, this is the end runaround that Patel clearly says, recognizing the government's issues with Patel. Patel is the law of the circuit, and it says that that judgment has to be read broadly, whatever kind of judgment, in another way the court puts it as any decision. And as the court has already stated, 5 U.S.C. 7062 is unreasonable delay or unlawful withholding. Had plaintiffs ask USCIS to make a decision and USCIS just doesn't do anything or says we're not going to get around to it, that's not what happened here. There was a decision. The decision was we don't have jurisdiction. And so had it been something else, they could have brought a different type of APA claim. But USCIS did render a decision.
What the service said in those decisions, I think across the board almost, was we don't have jurisdiction. You've got to go back to the IJ.
That's correct.
And seek relief there.
That's correct. And so that's a decision of USCIS. And that's barred by 1252A2B1, the way this court has read 1252A2B1.
Do you agree that we should hold an abeyance or stay or whatever it is pending Patel?
That is the government's position. This court should hold to see what the Supreme Court does. Because, I mean, Patel is the primary, is the reason the district court kicked this case. But even if Patel were to come back and the Supreme Court were to reverse this, you know, reverse Patel, overturn Patel, the administrative remedies are still available. There is no final agency action. This complaint brings two APA claims, and you have to have final agency action. And the regulations make clear that the immigration judge and the BIA is the proper fora for these types of claims.
Not under the government's position of Patel. Like, as I recall, the government's position is it only applies to the discretionary decisions underlying, but not the non-discretionary decisions. Wasn't that the government's position in Patel?
So this is the alternative argument that I'm talking about.
He's just asking about
Patel. I'm asking.
Sure. Yeah. No, the government's position is that it is only the discretionary decisions right. that are barred from.
And this and jurisdiction would not be a discretionary decision. So this would not apply. The jurisdiction.
Patel would not apply. However,
the jurisdiction stripping provision would not apply.
I'm sorry. The jurisdiction stripping provision would not apply. However, 5 U.S.C. 704, which says that you have to have final agency action. I would assume that had this case been brought and Patel not existed at the district court, we would have brought our final agency action 12B1 subject matter.
Let me ask you. So what if SCOTUS actually affirms Patel?
Let me just correct. I'm going to answer your question, Judge. Well, I'll go ahead and answer your question first. If the Supreme Court were to affirm Patel, then again, I mean, this case should be kicked for Patel. Pardon me, the district court dismissal should be affirmed.
Now, the final agency action rationale under the APA, if the agency is, so humor me on this hypothetical, the agency is using a we don't have jurisdiction rationale to never act one way or another. You're saying that can never be reviewed? Because it's not final?
Well, so the government's position is there has been action. USCIS acted. They said...
No. Not this case. I'm not talking about this case. It's a hypothetical. Other agency, take immigration out of it. Another agency is being asked to do X. And the agency says, can't do it, no jurisdiction.
No.
And you say, and then they try to challenge, and you say, not final.
Well, I would have to know the facts.
That's a never-ending loop, because the next time somebody else asks, the agency says, sorry, can't act, no jurisdiction. Someone tries to appeal, and you say, not final. And so no court is ever able to determine whether or not the agency has jurisdiction in the first place. I'm not sure that that's something that I would be comfortable signing off on.
Well, the two things that I would need to know, the government would need to know in that instance, is there another fora where this... plaintiff could plead their cause. A,
I haven't thought enough about it to give you an answer.
And then B, again, 5 U.S.C. 706-2 says that if the government has unlawfully withheld a decision, that is a right of action. And so I think the hypothetical that the court just offered, I would say that would probably be an unlawful withholding claim.
But you can only figure out the unlawful withholding if you figure out that the agency had jurisdiction. So you're doing a peek through to the...
I see.
You see what I mean?
Tied together.
Yeah. If that's your thinking, they run together.
But again, that's why the first question is there another fora? If the regulation in our instance, so taking it back to our case, says that's right, USCIS doesn't have jurisdiction. However, there is someone that does have jurisdiction, and that's the immigration judge. So that's the difference. That's the distinction that's very important. There is a fora where these plaintiffs, not only is there, and this is a distinction between I think it's Meja Rodriguez, which was dealing with, I think TPS, the benefit of TPS is, an IJ can grant TPS and so can USCIS, but the regulations do not require exclusivity of jurisdiction. Whereas in this case, adjustment of status, there is exclusivity. The regulations 8 CFR 1245.2A1 says that either the IJ or either USCIS has jurisdiction. So that's the difference.
And maybe that is a difference with significance. We'll see. Okay, Mr. Bateman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Prada, you've got your rebuttal time.
I have several points to make. There is no adequate remedy in the immigration court for two reasons, actually three. There's a BIA precedent matter of Yaudi that says you cannot reopen a case in immigration court to seek relief at USCIS. And what we're arguing...
So say the last part of that, Mr. Prada?
That you cannot reopen a removal order because you want to seek relief in front of USCIS. And that, if I recall correctly, was a Cuban individual...
But that would not only be to get relief under USCIS, because under the government's theory, accepting it for what it is, you would go to the immigration judge to remove the removal order, to eliminate the removal order. And then that puts you in a position where you can just sit. Most people wouldn't, but you can just sit, or you can try to adjust status with USCIS.
I think the way to look at it is that you're asking for a declaratory judgment from an immigration court, which they cannot do, because you move to reopen an immigration court for further proceedings or to challenge a finding of deportability. So in this situation, you're not saying that the removal order was invalid originally. I seek to reopen to vacate an invalid order. You're not seeking more relief in front of the court. You're seeking for the immigration judge to basically rule that, oh, yes, the proceedings are completed. There's nothing wrong with the completed proceedings. And what you have done in the future has legal significance outside of the removal proceedings. So that's not within the scope of an immigration judge's powers. But additionally, the regulations prohibit there's a departure bar in the regulations for sua sponte reopening, because these cases are not statutory reopening cases. They're not within the 90 days. I don't think there's an equitable tolling argument. So the regulations say that if you have departed, you may not seek sua sponte reopening in the immigration court. Matina specifically says after the departure. It applies to post-departure activity. So regardless of the prior discussion, this is prohibited by the agency's...
Judicial review does not mean that you lose. Judicial review means you have an avenue to assert your argument. Now, they may be wrong to foreclose you of that, and it may be that they're wrong to legally determine that the order of removal is still existing, such that those bars apply. But there's an avenue to file this stuff, and there's an avenue to make those arguments, and there's even an avenue to get to us, right?
Well, first of all, the Bootcut case in this court does not review denials of sua sponte motions to reopen.
Where it's based on agency discretion.
Yes, because in this situation, this would only be a regulatory discretion motion. It's out of time. So there, the agency itself, its own rules will not allow this motion to come up in the court, but even then, this court cannot review them under its own precedent. The only forum that exists is in the district court. Normally, it would be in habeas under Madu. Right, but we can't bring a habeas claim. The only remaining option is the APA, and I've hit my time, but I just want to get to your point, Judge Locke, about the scope of relief as a pattern in practice. Let's say that the court
got about a minute, Mr. Prada.
Yes, if you were going to limit the relief that we're seeking, we seek a declaration that the policy is arbitrary and capricious, and we ask for an injunction enjoining the defendants from applying their new policy in any and all matters in which it may be pronounced in the future. So that is not specific to anybody's case. That's more a direct attack on the policy.
There's no doubt that you do that, counsel, but okay. There's A through O in the relief section, and among those letters in the alphabet are the ones that I read, which are specific and individual to applying the declaration that you have to your individual cases such that you succeed.
Accepting what Your Honor is suggesting, and you would narrow the relief, I would say that F and I would be the remaining claims.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to take a 5-minute break, and then we'll be back for our last case.